What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. This is episode 24, and we are talking to Tish, who is a museum collections manager. And so we get into all of what exactly that means. She is super fascinating, though. I've known Tish for probably 12 years now. In fact, I think we decided it was exactly 12 years. I've known her for 12 years, and she just has an incredible story. I don't know that I've made this case on the podcast, but I'm beginning to understand more and more how much God's story in our lives fuels how we think about and how we do vocation. And Tish's story is a perfect example of that. She goes back into some of the trauma she experienced as a child. We get into some of her past, although not nearly all of it, I will tell you that. But she just talks about how history has shaped that and how her story has shaped how she views history. And it's super fascinating. You are going to really enjoy this interview. There is a bonus in this episode, though. At the very end, if you wait, Tish tells you about how we first met, and it is actually an incredible story. So you do not want to miss that at the very end of this episode. Be sure and like and share this episode and pop on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever and give me a review and a rating while you're thinking about it. I would greatly, greatly appreciate it. I cannot wait for you to hear what Tish has to offer. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Tish. All right, well, Tish, I can't say thanks enough for traveling from Iowa
Come.
A face-to-face interview is a lot of fun. So
much better.
So good to have you here. So
thanks.
Let's get this started by just having you introduce yourself to the folks.
All right, well, I'm Tish, and I am currently the collections manager and the registrar for the historical collection at the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque, Iowa. So it's about 3.5 hours away, give or take. I drive really fast. It's about three hours away.
In Tish time, it's three. But
it's three.
You know.
You know, if there's no cops on the road. I will start by saying I'm a historian by trade, yeah. But I've always been a storyteller and a story listener.
Yeah.
I love stories. I love how stories work. I love how people function with stories. So I guess the best way to start is to tell you some of my story.
I like it.
I am a triplet. I know that it's kind of weird to start with that, but it informs a lot of who I am, meaning it took a long time for me to become an individual thinker and an individual person. The three of us are the youngest of the kids in my family. I'm one of five. So I'm a youngest child, but I'm the oldest of the triplets. So I'm an oldest child, but I'm also a middle child. So I had the whole gamut of of birth order issues. Incredibly responsible. I'm a big rule follower. I like to know where my boundaries are. I like to be as far from the boundary as possible. I always feel ignored. I always feel like I'm out of the way.
So you take on like oldest child.
Yeah,
sort
and
of
that tendency
tendencies.
In that I'm like, I love the rules. What are the rules? What do I need to do? I take on the middle child tendencies and then I'm like, nobody sees me. How come nobody sees me? I'm right here. But then I do have moments of youngest child tendencies where I'm like, listen, I'm the baby. It's my way. I'm very particular about how I like things, so I can get very bossy and very like, this is how it's happening.
Wow, that's an interesting.
It's a weird place to be. I am from a fairly dysfunctional family in that I was raised by my dad and my stepmom. I've only met my birth mom once. I don't know her. I was raised in a Christian home, so I'm always grateful that I have always known who God is, but even in Christian homes, can be a lot of dysfunction. So for most of my life, I didn't know why I was created. We are the results of a fertility drug. So my dad would joke that there wasn't supposed to be three of us. It was just supposed to be a third child. And he would joke that I was the one who wasn't supposed to be conceived. I was the last conceived, but the first to be born. It was this weird thing.
Interesting.
So he would joke about it. It's so funny. But as a child, you take all those things in. So I still, as an adult, have moments where I fear that there's no actual purpose for me because I'm a product of science. I'm not a product of God's creation. So I have no future. I have nothing I'm supposed to be doing. God didn't make a plan for me because I wasn't supposed to be here. So I had to overcome that. And I still have, like I said, I still have moments where I have to fight that one out between me and God. And I have to say, okay, Lord, I trust that you have a plan and you have a purpose directly for me.
Right.
I also, in our family, from a military family, so there were rules and consequences, but definitely by the time I was in high school, I think my parents were just tired. So a lot of rule bending between my other two siblings, and it just created a lot of chaos. But the more I've looked at my own history, the more I realized there was always chaos. And that as a rule follower, and even as a kid with a hero complex, I thought if I could be good enough, if I could just be good enough, everything would work out. You know, I would say things to myself like, if I could just be good enough, then my parents won't fight, which my parents never actually fought in front of us, but you could tell there was tension.
Sure.
If I could just be good enough, you know, nobody in my family would do drugs. Well, then my sister went to rehab when we were freshmen in high school. She got pregnant when we were seniors, and I thought, I can be good enough. Like, nobody, no, you know, if I'm good enough, then all of these, all this chaos will like settle down. And it didn't. It just got worse.
Did you think good enough in a like a moral perspective?
Yes, okay. In a very moral perspective. Okay. So obviously I'm a sinner and I'm not perfect. So every time like I would be in the wrong, I lived with a lot of shame, and I lived with a lot of guilt, and I lived with a lot of self-hatred and a lot of like, you can be better. You can be better. And I think, unfortunately, this made me a very condescending and black and white person. When I was in high school and probably even into my early 20s, I made a lot of enemies, not on purpose, but because I had no grace. I didn't understand what grace would mean. And I didn't understand that you have to give people room to admit to their failures. I do actually see this a lot in my own father. He will not admit when he's wrong. And there's a lot of times where I just feel like, I'm okay with whatever you do as long as you're just honest about it.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Just be you. Just say it.
Yeah.
But that took a lot of years to come to. So I had a lot of baggage I carried. And some of it I still carry. I've not ashamed to admit I've been in counseling for quite a while.
We love our counselors, right?
I mean,
yes.
How to work through it. Before then, when I was 21, I had this opportunity to work with a church that was starting. Brand new church, 20 people. And it was Life Church. And I helped them with some of their marketing stuff in the early days. And I stayed with some girls that were the children's pastors. And they just took me in like I was their best friend. Like, I'd always been with them. And these were like the cool kids, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so I was like, oh, you like me. Actually, I remember one time they had a really tough conversation with me where one of the girls sat down and said, I like you for you. I'm not being nice to you because I work for the church. I like you. So stop being weird, okay? And I was like, oh.
That's awesome that she could have that conversation though, right?
Oh, man. Yeah. We were like, she was 22. I was like 21. So it was the first like real conversation where I realized I could have a difficult conversation with somebody and they wouldn't stop talking to me. In my family, if you get mad at somebody, you just don't talk to them for the next 20 or 30 years.
Sure.
Just how we roll.
Right.
We don't tend to be vicious per se to each other's faces, but we just won't talk to you forever. And then it's like, what did I do? I don't even know what I did.
Right.
So I was always trying to like make people like me. And these were the first people who were like, we just like you, okay? Get over it. This church, what do you say about people like Kurt and Lisa who just open their home and it doesn't feel weird to be like, on a Saturday night, it's 6 o'clock at night, I got nothing to do, so I'm just going to go hang out at the pastor's house and we're not going to talk about spiritual things. We're going to talk about silly things, or we're going to talk about whatever. You just lived life. And I'd never just lived life with people before. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know how that could look. I didn't know that people want to just be with you. I always had to work hard I didn't have friends when I was growing up very much. And I always had to work hard for those friendships. And these people just took me in. They just liked me. They just wanted to hang out with me. It was a very new experience for me. I was like, oh, I learned things about myself I didn't know. Like, I'm an extrovert and I like people. I didn't know that before my early 20s. I didn't know that it was okay for me to be weird and for me to hurt and for me to laugh and for me to, I'm a very loud laugher. And when I was in my early 20s, I was very quiet. I didn't know it was okay to be loud if I wanted to be loud. And they weren't going to stop asking me over just because I was a little bit off or right. I was a little bit strange. You know, they just invited me in and I just joined. So one of Life Church's favorite scriptures, which is actually one of my foundation scriptures, is out of the Psalms, Psalm 68, where it says that God puts the lonely in families right. and he sets the prisoners free to sing. And it took a lot of years to understand what that means, what that can mean for a person, that I was so lonely. I was so lonely. And God put me with people who showed me that there was more to me than how good I could be. There was more to me than how nice I could be. It was okay for me to get angry. I didn't know I was allowed to be angry right. about things. Yeah. Like, it was okay for me to think things were funny or to be a little off now and then or to just be grumpy. Like, these things are okay. And in that sense, God really showed me that this community, this life we call Christianity or the way or however you want to look at it, in the right setting and the way God means it to be, it's our family. And these are the people I cried with. These are the people I laughed with. These were the people who were like, you need counseling. Ultimately, these were also the people who said, what are you doing with your life, Tish?
Yeah.
I had coffee with my really good friend, Aaron. I was about 24 years old. I was working as a receptionist. And we had coffee one day and she just said, what are you doing with your life? And I was like, I'm working.
Right.
What am I supposed to do with my life? And she just, I'll never forget it. She said, Tish, a single woman in America needs a degree. You need to go to school. And my immediate response was, I'm not smart enough for school. What Aaron didn't know was that I wasn't the smart kid in my family. My dad has this beautiful habit of telling each and every other kid what each and every other kid is good at, except for the kid that he needs to tell it to. And I wasn't smart. I wasn't smart like any of my brothers and sisters. And so I always thought I couldn't handle college. And Aaron laughed in my face. It's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. You're one of the smartest people I know.
You got to love that hard truth, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. It was a little offensive, but it was also like, oh. So I took night classes at COD. And I, funnily enough, chose to go a history major route because I really wanted to study literature. I love stories.
Yeah.
I love stories. Yeah, right. So I originally wanted to study literature, but I was afraid I'd have to do too much writing. So I chose history. Genius.
Yeah, right?
Because all you do in a history degree is write.
Right. That's like a foolproof plan right there. Yeah. Good work.
Was so genius. But in a lot of ways, it just shows you that God knew what I didn't know.
Right.
In my ignorance, God knew where he wanted me to go. So in history, you not only write, you argue. It's really not about fact. I thought it was all about fact. I thought, oh, this will be great. I'm a very black and white person. I can just look at, like, you know, fact. Totally not. You can argue anything you want to in history as long as you have the documentation to back that up.
Interesting. I'd never thought of it that way.
You have the documentation to back that up. You can make that argument as truth. Huh. So I learned a lot of things. I learned how to tell stories. I learned how to argue in an intelligent manner. I learned how people connect with other people. I think that's one of the things about history that most people understand is that it connects everybody. So I learned how different things affect different things. As historians, we always make, you know, it's a very cliche statement. If you don't study history, you'll repeat it. But I feel like we repeat it anyways.
You're right. Yeah.
Doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I actually think the greatest source of documentation for that is Solomon. There's nothing new under the sun and everything is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. So even back before Christ, humanity knew that we're all the same and we will always do the same things. But I find some comfort in that as well. In an odd sort of melancholy way.
Yeah.
Like, it's cool. It's just humanity.
Yeah.
It's just how this works. So I studied history. I transferred to North Central College. I knew I didn't want to teach. I was too intimidated by that idea. What if somebody else knows something I don't? And the big joke in the liberal arts colleges, and especially amongst history students, is you either teach or you work in customer service. And I'd already worked in customer service and knew I didn't want that.
Yeah, I get that. I get that.
Hence the reason at 28 years old, I was graduating from college. So I was talking with my advisor one day and I just said, what do I do? What do I do? And she said, well, have you ever thought about a museum? And I said, I don't want to write exhibits, which I find really funny now because it's kind of what I want to
do
now.
That's what you want to do, right?
But she said, it's so much more than that. So I volunteered at the Napier Settlement and I worked in their collections department. And first day, I had to help catalog, which is where you write down all the pieces coming into a new donation. A donation of irons. Just irons. It's just laundry irons.
Right.
And it was like this person had collected them for years and had every type and variation of iron
of
you could
irons.
Think of.
Wow.
Bizarre. It was so amazing. Like, you know, the kind that you just set on the coal to warm up
yeah,
and then have
yeah,
to do, which
right.
by the way are freakishly heavy. Women in those days must have been so strong. To there was a gas run iron. It was amazing. I kept thinking, if I had to use a gas run iron, my house would be on fire.
Yeah, right?
To one of the very first electrical irons. Huh. I mean, just this huge array of irons. And I just remember that first week being like, this. How do I do this?
Right.
And so I learned the trade. And then I went to grad school to get my master's in museum studies, which I think, again, is just a huge feat to God's plan. I'm the only one in my family up to that point to hold a master's. My mother just recently received her master's. Sure. But yeah, I mean, it was a big thing for me. It, also speaking in family history, I am the oldest female in, I think, 7 or 8 generations who at my age is unmarried without children that I didn't want, you know, thank God.
Yeah.
To be educated, to have made a completely different path. Huh. So in my family, women in my family get married very young. They have lots of children, lots of drama after that, depending on the person. And that's what they do, you know. And we weren't stay-at-home moms in our later generations. They all worked, farmers' wives, ranchers' wives, definitely into the 20th century. My grandmother was a nurse during World War II. Mm-hmm. My mother held whatever jobs she could to help my dad pay the bills. But they didn't have a life of their own. They didn't make their own path. And I'm the first woman to do that. I'm the first woman to do that without having any regrets. And that's kind of special too, I think.
Yeah.
I think it just shows that sometimes you think you're only good for one thing. And then God comes along and he says, I have a different idea for you.
Right.
Why don't you try this? That's not to say I hope to stay single the rest of my life, you know, but it's just to say that I didn't make the wrong choice and just choose whoever, because that's the only way. In what God did for me, he showed me that there could be another way and that I don't have to work a dead end job and I don't have to just do whatever, but that he had a different plan. So after grad school, I got my first job in a museum, and I now work, like I said, as a collections manager and a registrar. And that basically boils down to I take care of the historical collection. I pull it out for exhibit and clean it. I've learned some different ways to clean historical items so that they can be pristine when they go on display. I put it back after exhibit. I am a Tetris master when it comes to storage space. I actually really enjoy how boxes fit on shelves. I get really, really nerdy when I start talking.
Boxes fit on shelves.
Oh my gosh. And powder coated steel shelving and compactable shelving and how much extra space you can get out of that. And it's this weird thing. And in the archives world, they have this new system where they have all these little boxes that fit in the standard size box and they're called nesting boxes. Probably after the idea of Russian nesting dolls. And I want them so badly. Every year I put them in my budget, and every year my boss says, they're not necessary. Knock it off.
That's amazing.
But I love how it all fits together.
Yeah.
I love organization, which I didn't understand until recently when I was talking with a friend who's a pastor, that organization actually creates space, and space creates places for people to breathe.
Yeah.
I never understood why I loved that so much, but I was like, oh.
That's interesting.
That makes sense. A place to breathe. So I like how I can do that. So yeah, I talk to new donors. So I get to make friends with people. Like I literally get paid to just sit and listen to somebody tell me about this thing that they want to donate to the museum.
Yeah.
Which sometimes is awesome and other times is not so awesome.
I bet.
Depends on the person. Yes, depends on the thing.
Right. And the history, I assume, behind it, right?
And the history behind it, yeah. Whether or not I can get excited about
right.
Why is this important? Oh, that's why it's important. Right.
Yeah, there are so many questions here. Like, because you're...
That's
you're,
a long right? story. Well, I'm sorry.
No, it was good. It was really good. It was a great intro. I just feel like you're the only museum employee I've ever met, right?
Oh.
I mean, you know... Wow. I just feel like
we
it's not
to actually be introverts, so
right.
I'm such an oddity for my field. Well,
okay, so that's actually what I was thinking. It is because it does seem like it shouldn't work, right? To have an extrovert
work
in a
work
museum, right? So what is that? Is that the...
Why does that
yeah,
work?
Yeah, why does that work?
That's a really good question because I ask myself too. Here's why I think it works. And this is going to sound really grandiose, and it is definitely not this grandiose every day. When you're in the trenches, it's like, just keep your head above water.
Sure.
But it is very important to me to help preserve history so that people can understand where they come from. I think in our world, we walk around and we think nobody is like us. And I think what history can do for us is show us that there are people who understand you. You know, we're in a society where we're finally saying things out loud. You take things like postpartum depression. I think that's one of the big ones I think of. Women are actually talking about it
right.
now, you know,
yeah.
and they're seeing people for it. But through journals, sometimes you can hear it in past generations. I think sometimes through other people's stories, when I think about my mother abandoning me, I can actually hear her own sorrow and that she tried, she thought that this would make her happy. She thought this is what I'm supposed to do. So she did it only to realize I've made the wrong choice. And that might be a little gracious. I'm still working through some issues with her. But there are times that I can almost feel it. My grandmother is a very bitter woman. I actually haven't talked to, it's very toxic, but when I've unpacked her life, when I've unpacked the choices she made, why she married my grandfather, I can see that in a lot of ways, she was just trying to work out life just like I'm trying to work out life.
Sure.
And maybe that wasn't the best choice, you know? But
yeah.
But instead of being able to say to herself, let me go talk to other people or let me see how other people have overcome this, she just stayed insular within herself. And what I think history can do, especially at a historical society, which our foundation is a historical society, it can help people realize that we're not alone. And the things we experience have been experienced before. And triumphs are still triumphs. And we can still be excited about things like tea sets, you know. And isn't it interesting that people used to take so much time to brew tea when we can just put it in a microwave? Or One of our great artifacts, this artifact that I think is so amazing. It's a handheld self-tanner from the 1940s.
Wait, what?
A handheld self-tanner. Right, I know. Like we think of tanning as like a modern thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
oh,
yeah.
I'm going to go tanning.
Right.
I think the tanning bed is a modern thing. But we have this, I discovered it one day and I was like, this is so weird.
Sounds super dangerous.
Super dangerous. Like it actually says in the paperwork, because I have like the original manual that goes with it, that the tube that helps tan you has mercury and UV light. And there's actually in the manual, it says that it's very healthy to tan your baby for an hour a day
what?
To make sure they get enough vitamin D. How what? Funny is that? Yeah, it's so weird. But
wow.
We now like, so we can look at that and we can be like, wow, you know, people were always a little obsessed with being tan, first of all.
There you go.
Which is a very weird thing, which actually is a 20th century idea.
Sure.
But also that... You know, it's kind of connects us. We're all still kind of similar.
Right.
And we all still want kind of the same. We want to look a certain way.
Yeah.
We want to feel a certain way. We now know it's bad for you.
Right, right.
But we didn't always know it was bad for you.
That's fascinating. Gosh. I would think that most curators, people who work in museums, are introverts. And so
yeah,
I would imagine that you have a strength that most in your field don't, in that you can talk to people pretty easily.
I'm not too weird. I mean, I'm weird once you get to know me, but like in a first meeting sort of way, I can be confident in what we're talking about. I can also handle interactions with the public. So when my boss hired me, actually, she was like, I was just excited to hire somebody who wasn't weird. unfortunately, this type of field, and maybe fortunately, it depends on the size of the institution. It depends on the work being done. It tends to pull people who like to work alone, people who want to focus on one thing only. I know archivists who are in charge of three or four collections only instead of everything. Unfortunately, though, with funding cuts and things like that, a lot of us have to wear many, many hats. And that can be difficult for introverts who get really exhausted when they have to talk to people.
Sure.
It's not as difficult for me. Now, there are people that just drain you. That's life. Yeah. And I have had to talk to some people right. that I'm like, I have so much to do. I need you to now leave me alone. but that's life. You're always going to find that. So I'm really blessed in that my personality actually works for the 21st century collections manager.
Sure. One of the most fascinating things I think about your job is that I never thought through like maintaining a collection meant doing like crazy stuff to maintain your collection, right? Like if you get water in a building with a museum, like
disaster.
Right. It never crossed my mind. Yeah.
So in the museum world, you always have this catchphrase thing that you learn called disaster preparedness, how to be prepared for the worst. And in a lot of ways, in every different museum, they will have a disaster prepare plan that is more specific to what they do. So we are a museum and an aquarium. And what that means is we have living collections and non-living collections. I'm in charge of the historical collections. We have lots of water, so much water, a lot of water tanks. And I have storage beneath the aquarium.
Beneath the aquarium.
So I've got water pipes running through my ceiling. So wow. I listen to my music very loudly so I don't have to listen to the water.
Sure.
And we're constantly trying to fix that and work on that. In fact, I would say the best working relationship I have at my museum is with the living collections because they are just as particular about their collection as I am. Unfortunately, if something goes wrong in their world, they can lose life. Like animals can die, which almost never really happens for us. They're really, really good at what they do. For me, things don't die, but if something in my collection deteriorates, depending on whether or not it's a duplicate of something or not.
Right.
I have lost that.
You may have the one that's in existence.
I may have the one thing that tells this one story and it's gone. Actually, I don't know if you've seen this on the news, but there was a museum in Brazil, the Brazilian Natural History Museum burned down a couple weeks ago.
Oh, I didn't see that.
And it had a world-class collection of natural history. Huh. I mean, birds that have been extinct for centuries they had in this collection.
What?
And it's gone. Huh. It's all, you don't recover. Fire recovery, I mean, the kind of flames they have, you don't recover from that.
Wow.
You don't. They actually had pictures of curators running out with their arms full of whatever they could grab. I wept. I literally wept. Some disasters you can recover from. If you get smoke, you can recover from smoke. Right.
Water probably is a little tricky.
Water depends. Yeah. It depends on the material and it depends on how quickly you get to it.
Sure.
So you think in context, we're a museum and an aquarium. So I've got water from the aquarium.
Yeah.
We are also, people probably don't know this, but Dubuque, Iowa is literally on the Mississippi River. Our museum is on the harbor of the Mississippi River. So I literally am on water.
Wow.
And we're really fortunate at Dubuque in 1965, they had this huge flood that went to the second story of many buildings in the downtown area.
Wow.
And so after that, they built flood walls that they close at certain times of the year. And then the harbor has flood gates. And so when the water raises a certain height, especially in the spring, when all the snow is melting north, coming down, they'll close the floodgates and they'll pump water back out into the river. So we're fortunate in that. That does not mean that I do not have a plan ready for the day that the Mississippi says, ha, 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 you think you can keep me out.
So you have a plan for that?
I have a plan for it. Now, I don't know how successful the plan would be right. because I haven't had to try it yet. Also, an evac plan for that many items would be difficult. But I have certain items marked in storage. Sometime you'll have to come to the museum. I'll show you storage.
Yeah.
I have it marked with these signs that say, in case of emergency, grab first. because I know that in the case of an emergency, I'm going to just have to pull other people. They're like, come with me. Look for the green sign.
Yeah. So in your current museum, which items are on the grab first list?
A lot of it's furniture because we have some very important furniture. I would say, one of the first thing is I have these two books that are cyanotype pictures, and a cyanotype is a lot like a sepia, which is that tan color.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Cyanotypes are blue. They're gorgeous. And they're cyanotype pictures of the upper Mississippi River between 1883 and 1891, taken by a photographer named Henry Bossy. And he worked for the Army Corps of Engineers. And he was taking these pictures when they were trying to decide where they were going to put the lock and dams. And so basically, he's just photographing the upper Mississippi. I'm not sure if he photographed the lower or not. As far as I know, there's only 5 of these books in existence. We have 2 of them.
Wow.
They are definitely on my grab first. In fact, I'm actually considering moving them to the other building where I have storage that's above the aquarium.
Sure.
Because cyanotypes, you don't recover from if those get wet. I also have a desk from A.A. Cooper. A.A. Cooper built wagons in Dubuque, and he built these beautiful wagons. And at one point, they thought he was probably the wealthiest man in Dubuque. The story is that Henry Ford crossed the river and asked A.A. Cooper if he would join him in his adventure of the horseless carriage. And Cooper said no. Nobody would ever buy a horseless carriage.
Oh, my God.
It was his son who had to sell the business because that was the time period, you know. Well, I have his desk that he used when he was working. And it's this massive desk, beautifully carved, these great little gargoyles on it. I mean, it's just fabulous. It's really massive, so I haven't actually thought about how that would be carried out.
Right.
And I got it into a very small door. So, you know, in the event of an emergency, that might be a little more difficult.
Right.
But it is made of wood, and wood is very bad in water. Yeah. I have a wicker coffin.
What?
Yes. This is one of my favorite pieces because it's so awesome and creepy at the same time. It's a temporary coffin. So at the end of the Victorian era, this was probably early 1900s. So it's right before the end of Victoria's reign. The Victorians made an art form out of grieving. And mostly that was when Victoria lost Albert. She grieved him for 20, 30 years. She set out his clothes every day. She wore black. She always wore black after that. And in the Victorian time, if you lost a loved one, you would wear black for the first year. You would wear gray for the second year, and then you would wear purple.
Really?
Before you went to like actual clothes again. Yeah, it was this, grieving was this like
3 years.
Yeah, it was like this huge thing.
That's so foreign to us today,
right? It's so weird. Like we think,
Week is like,
think, okay, we'll get over it. Yeah, it's been 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Although counselors tell you it takes a good 2 years to fully grieve.
Sure.
That's just amazing. If you're processing it.
Yeah, right. That's just amazing how physical that is because that's like a daily reminder, right?
Daily reminder. I can't even imagine. So there was this culture and this fascination with death, this fascination with loss, but also this fascination with they were beginning to become more aware of things like epilepsy and like comas and things of that sense. And so there was this macabre fear of being buried alive. So you would, I suspect, and I would really have to check the historical record before I could say absolutely, but I suspect that the idea of the wake came from this. So you have a wake in your house when your loved one has died, and you have a party basically to make sure that they wake up before you bury them.
Right.
You know, so the temporary coffin was used for the wake in your parlor. And then you take it back and you put it in the real coffin and you bury it. So this coffin's probably, and it was used in Dubuque. It's probably had a couple of different bodies in it. I know.
That is crazy.
Awesome and creepy.
Yeah,
it's
right?
It's amazing.
Yes.
So, but it's made out of wicker. Definitely don't want to get that wet.
Yeah.
I have a chair that Abraham Lincoln sat on during a Lincoln Douglas debate. Very interesting story how that came to us. It was donated in the 70s by a woman whose uncle was at this debate and purchased the chair afterwards.
What?
And he gave it to his niece, who happened to live in Dubuque. So it's in my collection. I have a sword that was given to a French general from Napoleon Bonaparte. This family just fascinates me. I'll probably write a book about them someday, maybe, if I ever get the chance to actually study them. He was a general. He died in France, but his daughter brought this sword with her when she immigrated to Dubuque in the 1850s. The sword that was, now I think this is more of a PR stunt. I mean, Napoleon was notorious for making stories that weren't real.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, right.
But the family story was that in the middle of a battle, the general's sword broke and Napoleon rode up heroically and said, "Here, take mine," you know. Now, whether or not that happened, I don't know. Whether or not it was just, "Oh, here, have it," or whether or not Napoleon's like, "Hey, I'd like for you to have this sword." We don't really know.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's in Dubuque, Iowa.
Yeah. Napoleon's sword. Wow.
You know, so that is definitely on my grab first.
Yeah, sure.
You don't want that to rust. So there's a lot of these types of things that, to me, they tell really interesting Dubuque stories. They tell, this French family I was just talking about tells about the kind of people who immigrated to Dubuque during that immigration out west.
Yeah.
Cooper tells these wonderful stories about all of the innovation and industry. Like, you don't think of Dubuque, Iowa as a place of industry, but up until probably the 80s, I mean, some major corporations were in Dubuque. And I think a lot of that had to do with the river. It was easier to transport your product down the river.
Yeah.
You know,
water's always where industry goes, right?
It's a transport. Yeah. So Dubuquers in particular are very, very passionate about their history. And they want to save it. Yes. And they want to tell it. And if you get one of the old guys in, oh my gosh, you better just prepare for two hours worth of conversation.
You're like, I'll take a coffee, right?
Yeah, right. Like, don't even think it's going to be less than an hour. Because they're going to want to tell you everything that they know. And they know it.
Yeah.
They know it. They love it. Yeah. So
that's awesome. Dubuque, Iowa.
Dubuque, Iowa.
Yeah, that's place to go. These museums in small towns. It's just fascinating.
Places,
okay, so... now for the second half of our podcast here, right?
This is going to be a long one. Sorry, right.
Well,
people.
No, we've already discussed that you have a lot of thoughts about history and God and just, I mean, I see God's hand so just present in your life, right? Like how you talked about you're the first woman in your family to sort of lead this path, like change the game, I guess, so to speak, right? Like, I feel like God's hand has been on sort of like your life, and you can see it just present in your history. So how do you see God in what you do for a living now?
Okay. So a little bit of philosophy here.
Yeah.
Philosophical ideas of Tisch. I think, first of all, Christianity has the best story, right? The Bible is full of how God moves.
Yeah.
And I think in a lot of ways, the Old Testament is like my heart.
Yeah.
Love the Old Testament because that's where God just kind of lays out the story. And we as Christians believe that this is how God reached out to save humanity, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's larger than that. I think we limit ourselves when we think that this is the only way that God shows his story. I think all of history shows God's story, good, bad, and everything in between, because even the bad parts of history tell us that sin is still present and that there's still a very real enemy who is after not only our souls but our very existence.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And the good parts of history tell us that God is still in control and that God will still do his thing. So in that, I would say, I've already mentioned Solomon, I would say that Ecclesiastes is probably my favorite book. Which most people are like, it's so depressing.
right.
But I come from a lot of trauma and I'm kind of melancholy by nature, which is really weird as a positive extrovert.
Yeah, you have a lot of dichotomy going on, right? Like you have a...
The ultimate paradox right here, people.
Right. Tish is the paradox. Yeah. Yeah.
I think... So how I like to really think and explain is that I'm a very deep feeler. So I feel things very, very deeply, whether I'm happy or I am sad. It is with all of my being and in the depths of my soul, which... When I was younger, it was really difficult to reconcile. I couldn't figure out why there was so much thought and so much feeling. But the older I get, the more I realize that that's just part of how God specifically created me. Hmm. Why? I won't know this side of heaven. I'm trying to embrace it and accept his creation, you know. So I love Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes has a couple of really good, really good gems in the midst of all of the sorrow. And probably one of my favorites is in chapter 3, after he goes through the list of there is a time for this, you know, sure. There's a time for everything. When he goes through that list, he says, God has placed everything in its time, which I think is kind of a deep thought right there.
Yeah.
God has placed everything in its time, and God has set eternity in the hearts of men, and men do not understand it. So what does that mean? This would be Tish, not the scripture from here on out. I think what that means is that we all have this longing for God. You know, you have this deep longing for eternity, for eternal things. And we don't always understand that, whether you're a Christian or you're not. As a Christian, I myself struggle with the idea of eternity because I measure everything by time,
sure.
By the historical record.
Right, you're a historian.
And
right.
Eternity is no time. And I freak out when I think, what does no time mean? So I try not to think about it too much, to be honest. But what I think that eternity in us really means is that we all long for more than what this physical life gives us. Hmm. I think what historians try to do is remember people, right? I guess it's hard to kind of explain, but this thought came to me as I was wandering through a cemetery. I'm so weird. I love cemetery walks because I love the idea that if I know different things, I can find the people who lived. So there's a great cemetery in Dubuque called Linwood Cemetery, and it's where all the famous people in Dubuque are buried. And I know where they are.
That's so, like the posh cemetery.
Oh my gosh. It's like I can walk through it. I could be like, oh, and you were an early settler and you did this and you did that. Yeah. And I know who you are. So I've actually gone a couple of times to visit some of these people, if you will, to visit their graves and just contemplate what their life actually meant here on earth. And it just occurred to me one day while I was doing this, while I was walking this pathway, that I thought, you know, why do people come to cemeteries? You know, you see people lay flowers on people's graves, you know. And all I could think was because everybody wants to be remembered. We want to know that what we're doing, even if what we're doing is boring, is going to outlive us, right? Hmm. And in that, I think we find where God says, you will live beyond. You know, where God says, I have placed eternity in your heart. I have, within every person's soul, placed this thing to let you know that your life is more than this moment. Hmm. And I think that can be very powerful. And I think... If I as a historian can help somebody realize that their purpose is not the 9-to-5 job they go to or the next or trying to avoid the next fight they're going to have with their spouse, but that their purpose is something more, then maybe they'll learn to communicate better with their spouses. Maybe they'll learn how not to feel like they're alone.
Amen. I find it fascinating because you sort of started off this whole conversation talking about your grandmother. And one of the things that struck me was just about her past, but you know, you have a contentious relationship now, but there was grace that you found in her story, right? And it almost seems like story for you and history
softens the blow.
Yeah. And it begets like sort of this grace that we have for,
well, I think it creates understanding.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the first thing that you have to do, right? When you look at a, especially when it comes to family and it comes to relationship, let's just say relationship. Yeah. Somebody has hurt me. Okay, I'm definitely going to take that personally,
right.
You know, but to heal, right, we have to look at, why am I hurt?
Right.
To heal, I have to look at, why did you lash out at me? What is it about what's going on in you that lashed out to me?
Right.
And then no matter what that response is, we have to find forgiveness, right?
Yeah.
I had a very intense moment with God once. I journal. I despair for the person who's going to find my journals someday because they are many.
It'll be history. Somebody
will go be some crazy history. Yes. But I tell myself these stories. I remind myself of these things so I remember why I have to do things. I have a very contentious relationship with my father, mostly on my side. He doesn't realize because I'm very careful about. I could speak truth that would be incredibly damaging. And I'm constantly in this phase with God where what is the most loving thing to do? Sure. Is the most loving thing to do to speak that truth? Or is the most loving thing to do to try to figure out why he's treating me a certain way? Yeah. I have decided for myself, the most loving thing to do is to not engage. And since he doesn't call me, that means we don't talk. We don't have a relationship, which I've had to reconcile myself to. And I'm, you know, God's really done a lot in me. But before that happened, I was in this stage where I had so much unforgiveness, I couldn't breathe. I had never experienced this before. I was going to Life Church at the time. I think this was before I was in grad school, actually. I was on the worship team. And I had to step down from the worship team. I don't think I told anybody this. Huh. I just started telling Kurt on Sunday mornings I didn't feel like singing anymore.
Sure.
I couldn't sing anymore. Which for me was a huge indicator of where my heart was. No matter where I've been emotionally, no matter what trauma I have gone through, no matter what, I have always found comfort and solace in worship and music and singing and praising God. But I couldn't do it anymore. And I kind of freaked out about it. I was in counseling, so I was talking to my counselor about it. We weren't really getting to this place. And there was this Sunday morning, and I was standing in my row, and music started, and I was just like, blah, 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 which, again, should have been a huge indicator that something was wrong. Yes. But it wasn't. And I was like, oh, whatever. I'm so annoyed. Why are we singing so many songs? Blah. And I walked to the back of the room because I thought, okay, you got to get out of the middle here. People are going to start going, something's wrong here.
Yeah.
I walked to the back of the room and he just started crying. And I thought, well, what are you crying for? What's the problem? And I found myself on my knees just crying and listening to the music, letting the music wash over me. I can't even tell you what song it is. And in the middle of this, for one of the very few times in my life, I heard the voice of God. And all he said was, you have to forgive him. And I couldn't pretend that I didn't know who him was.
Right. Like, right. God's so good at that, right?
Like, no, I was like,
so few words.
What?
That says so many things. Yeah.
Yes. And my response, I mean, I am on the floor on my knees. I am hunched over. I am rocking back and forth weeping. And my response is literally, you can't ask me to do that. Huh. You have to forgive him. I will not do that. You have to forgive. I mean, it was like this fight. I was like, God speaking calmly to me. I am almost shouting. At one point, I'm like, you're going to start shouting out loud. People are going to be like, what's going on with Tish? You know? But I just kept saying, I can't do that. You can't ask me to do that. Do not ask me to. I mean, I was very aggressive about it. I was like, I won't do it. I won't do it. And God just kept saying it. Just kept saying, you have to forgive him. And I got calm. And then I heard God say, if you don't forgive him, there's no room for me to forgive you. Huh. And I tell you, Curry, I wept like I have not wept before because I realized what my unforgiveness was doing, what my inability to understand why he was acting the way he was acting, my inability to give grace to him in that moment was blocking the grace that God was trying to show me. Huh. God is continually reaching out to his people and he's continually trying to show us that he forgives us, that he has grace for our mistakes. But if I can't return that to the people around me, it fills up, it builds a wall. It fills me up with hatred. It fills me up with disappointment. It fills me up with sorrow. It fills me up with all these things. And it was this really powerful moment and it took a really long time to figure out how to do it. But I have these moments from time to time. So what does that mean in a history context? What it means is that for me to understand why I feel the way I do about myself, my insecurities, the way I function, the way I build walls, I quite frankly have an expert wall builder.
Yeah, sure.
My defenses are because of the way I was taught as a child. But to understand how I was taught as a child, I have to understand how my parents were taught.
Yeah.
Even if my parents are trying to do something completely separate from the way their parents did it, I have to understand that pathway. And in a lot of ways, that is how I have found the grace to forgive. Because my dad was never told that he was important. And so he didn't know how to tell his children that they were important. So it gets complicated, but I definitely would say if you feel like you're in the situation or a situation where you're like, I don't know why we fight all the time, go find out why somebody's so angry.
Yeah.
You know, and if they don't know, and here's the thing, I couldn't just ask my dad why he was such a jerk. You know? He doesn't know he was a jerk. In fact, if you ask my dad, he would tell you he was an amazing father and he doesn't understand why none of his children taught him. None of the five of us taught to him. He would tell you, I'm amazing. I don't get it. If you only look at life from this, you've done me wrong, you're never going to find that grace.
Right.
And in the end, I think it's dishonest to Christ. I mean, really, there is no reason why God should love me. I am a sinner. I have done wrong. I continue sometimes. I willfully do wrong sometimes, you know. There's no reason why God should have decided to adopt me other than that he loves me. Mm-hmm. And if God can just forgive me and be gracious to me, who am I to say, no, can't do that. Can't do that. I do think people have to protect themselves though, and I do want to say that.
Yeah, sure.
There are violent relationships and there are toxic relationships. Yeah. And that's not God's will for anybody's life. Yeah. So
no.
But yeah.
That's good. That's the gospel.
Yeah.
Preaching the gospel. I love it. I love it.
Okay. All true story.
Right. It's wonderful. The gospel's the,
It's so, the common thread.
Gosh, we could.
I could talk forever. Yeah, right. We should probably cut it off at some point.
So let's go through the final two questions though.
Okay.
You're a fan of the podcast, so you know the questions well, right?
A little bit.
Okay. So what would you say is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Gosh, I've had a lot of jobs. I'm trying to think. I've had a lot of boring jobs. I will tell you the strangest thing I have learned in my career. How about that?
Yeah, that's perfect.
I have, oddly enough, become an expert in mold. So here in the Midwest, almost every museum deals with mold. It's a humidity temperature thing. And I have had two separate museums now where I've had to do mold cleaning of artifacts. And this last time around, I found out that my IT guy at my work, his mother is a microbiologist. So I scraped some of the mold off, sent it to his mom, and she's actually identified our particular brand of mold, which is disappointingly incredibly common. So, but I've actually now have a couple of books on the subject of mold and heritage collections. And if you would have told me 8-9 years ago when I started this gig that I'd become an expert in mold, I would have laughed in your face.
I love that. That's great.
So it's strange. It's weird. It's not what I would have chosen, but it's very common in our neck of the woods for what we do. So the more I can learn about it, the better I can handle it.
It's amazing in these jobs, the things you get yourself into.
Yeah,
that you
so weird.
Know, right? Okay. So then finally, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom into their vocation?
Wow. These are so deep. I always forget about that. I think the biggest piece of advice I would give is to remain in the Word and listen. I think all of our jobs can be stressful from time to time, and you definitely get discouraged and you get to a place where you think, I'm done. And I think when you're in the Word every day, your whole mindset is different. Your whole brain is different. And I know I can feel it. I can feel it when I'm in the Word and I can feel it when I'm not. Usually when I'm not in the Word though, it's taken a couple weeks before I realized, oh, you're struggling because you haven't spent time with Jesus.
Right.
So I would say if you want to bring God into everyday conversation, have God on your brain.
That's good.
Have God on your, God will be on your lips if he's on your brain.
Mm. Yeah. I love that. That's good stuff. Such good stuff. Tish, thank you for coming
over. You're so welcome.
This is awesome. I learned so much stuff I didn't know. Like, we've known each other
12 years. JJ and I just worked it out. Crazy. We've known each other for 12 years.
Yeah, I love just hearing about your story and just kind of nerding out, right?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, we briefly have to tell people how we met. I met JJ and Curry when they first came to Life Church. It was their very first Sunday. Yes. And our worship leader at the time, Devin, and his wife were good friends of mine. And Andre and I were, Devin worked with you, right, at Starbucks?
We kind of
knew each other.
Yeah.
So Andrea was telling me what a weird mood she was in that day. I should have known, actually. Yes. But she was like, hey, there's this new couple over there. And I think they're Devin's friends from Starbucks. I think that's the guy he works with. So let's go say hi. And I was like, great. I love people. Let's go say hi. So Andrea introduced herself as Devin's wife. And then she introduced me. I'm pretty sure she introduced me.
Yes.
Devin's second wife, which, of course, I just played along with. And then you guys walked away from us. And I turned to her and I was like, you know, that's the last time they're ever coming, right?
Oh, man.
We just totally freaked them out.
And who knew that polygamy jokes were our sweet spot? We were like, man, these are our people. It was just like, I love a church where you can say something like that to somebody and we could just be weird
on the first initial contact. And
that's how it should be, right? Authentic.
Like, I'm just strange. So yeah,
that's great.
But 12 years.
That's a great story. And to be fair, Andrea is always in a weird mood. So, you know.
I just play along with her shenanigans.
That's right. Well, Tish, you're awesome. And thanks for sharing.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Good stuff. Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Tish today. She has such an incredible story. I just really think there's so much to learn there. She's processed so much of what she's gone through and come out on the other side stronger. She is really a testament to those who really process their baggage and deal with it and move along. And just to be able to see what God does in her life is incredible. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Give me a like and a share if you can. I would greatly appreciate it. And until next time, get out there and hustle. We'll